History through the eyes of those who lived it. This is Hometown Heroes, presented on the air and online by Provident Payments, proudly honoring the men and women whose service and sacrifice have secured our freedom. Now, the host of Hometown Heroes, Paul Leffler.
Welcome to another edition of Hometown Heroes, the program that reminds you no matter where you live in this great country of ours, no matter how big or how small your hometown might be, there are stories there that should not go untold. What we've learned is that they don't have to go untold, as long as we're willing to take the initiative to ask a few questions, and more importantly, to take the time to patiently listen as memories that may have been buried for decades begin to emerge again. Our goal is to honor our veterans for their service and sacrifice, to preserve their stories so we never forget the price that's been paid for our freedom. And along the way, not only are we educated, not only are we entertained, but so often we find ourselves truly inspired by these stories from our greatest generation. This past December, of course, we marked the 80th anniversary of the attack on Pearl Harbor, but next weekend will be the 80th anniversary of another significant event, another one of those elements of history that is crucial to remember so that it is not repeated. We're going to focus on it this weekend, so perhaps you'll be able to participate in local observances where you live next weekend. On February 19th, 1942, President Franklin D. Roosevelt issued Executive Order 9066, the end result of which was the incarceration of approximately 120,000 Americans of Japanese ancestry. About two-thirds of them were American citizens born here in this country. In many of the areas where this program airs, Day of Remembrance ceremonies will mark that 80th anniversary. And speaking of our radio affiliates, we're proud to welcome Money Talk 1230 KSBN in Spokane, Washington, to the Hometown Heroes family this week. Spokane was a spot where approximately 2,500 Japanese Americans flocked after 9066 as a bit of a safe haven. But many families never had that opportunity. Uprooted from their homes and taken first to temporary assembly centers and then to long-term holding facilities euphemistically referred to as relocation centers, but more commonly known to those interned there as concentration camps. Manzanar, on the eastern slope of the Sierra Nevada Mountains in Southern California, was the first camp to receive internees. There were 10,000 there by the final year of World War II, and Manzanar remains the most well-preserved of the 10 camps. It is now a National Historic Site operated by the National Park Service. And if you head there to Manzanar next weekend, you can mark this 80th anniversary by taking in the Go for Broke Spirit photo exhibit by Shane Sato. Sato has published two books of portraits totaling more than 150 Nisei veterans of World War II, some of whom have shared their stories here on Hometown Heroes. And this special exhibit at Manzanar will feature nine larger-than-life portraits and the corresponding biographies. At hometownheroesradio.com, I have links to that and a list of other upcoming Day of Remembrance events. Some of them feature World War II veterans. Many of them feature Dr. Mitch Mackey, who leads the Go for Broke National Education Center, whose ongoing traveling exhibit, Courage and Compassion, which we've talked about before on Hometown Heroes, will soon reach the Dallas-Fort Worth Metroplex and be there through June of this year at the Dallas Holocaust and Human Rights Museum. That powerful exhibit makes it quite clear that if this kind of injustice to American citizens could happen 80 years ago, it could happen again in this country if we fail to be vigilant. Over the years on Hometown Heroes, we've heard quite a few Nisei veterans share their memories, giving the rest of us a sense of just how significant the disruption to their lives, their families, and their fortunes was. You can link to all of those interviews at hometownheroesradio.com, from 442nd Regimental Combat Team veterans like Medal of Honor recipient Joe Sakato or Purple Heart recipient Lawson Sakai, to military intelligence service veterans who ended up in the Pacific like Clarence Suzuki or Sherman Kishi. But today I want to zero in on Sam Terasaki's story. I had the privilege of meeting Sam in Denver several years ago, and the way he articulated not only his own experience, but the broader view of that era is very powerful. What a contrast from a young man initially classified as 4C, enemy alien and unable to serve, to marching to the White House at the end of the war to have President Harry Truman brave the rain and pin a presidential unit citation on the 442 flag. But we're going to go back to what started it all. When Imperial Japan attacked Pearl Harbor on December 7, 1941, Sam Terasaki was a 17-year-old senior at Denver East High School, during an era in which there were only around 3,000 Japanese Americans in the entire state of Colorado.
While they called an all-school assembly, they called, three or four of us into the principal's office without telling us why, and we sat in the principal's office. Turned out that one of the speakers, and this was post-December 7th, the featured speaker that day was Mrs. Gates, whose family ran the Charles Gates tire manufacturing business in Denver. They owned a winter home in Hawaii, and she was in Hawaii, I guess, during the December 7th attack.
Wow.
Turns out, I guess, the speech was some propaganda that actually some things that she felt were going on that proved later on to be false, like cutting arrows in the cane fields and sabotage by the Nisei and stuff like that.
Wow. But you didn't get to hear the speech?
I didn't find out about the speech until later on.
So what did they tell you when you went to the office?
Nothing. They just asked us to sit there.
So they didn't want any students of Japanese descent hearing what she was saying?
Yeah.
Wow.
I'm not sure whether that was the reason or whether they felt there'd be backlash with our presence there or not.
Uh-huh.
December 7th, I was out rabbit hunting with my brother, one of my brothers, and his friend, Joe Morshige, who was killed in the war, I think in Italy or France. We went rabbit hunting with our .22 rifles, and it was a weird thing. We actually went around the outskirts of what was a new air base called Laurie Field. It had moved here from Illinois, and relatively new. I think it moved here sometime in 1937 or something. We didn't know anything about the start of the war until we got home. But in hindsight, I imagine three guys with rifles in a trying to tell officials that we were hunting rabbits when we're circling around a military base.
A base on high alert because they just heard that Pearl Harbor was attacked.
I don't know whether they were on high alert or not.
Wow. I know we're going to hear some stories that are going to amaze us at how you survived in Europe, but it's somewhat surprising you survived that if you're a young Japanese-American yeah. with a gun by an Air Force base. Hey, so then you get home, and you hear it on the radio, or your folks tell you?
Yeah. And then I don't know how long later, whether it was a day or 2 days or a week, but the FBI came to our home, interviewed each one of us separately.
Wow.
I was 17 years old.
You're a 17-year-old kid getting grilled by the FBI?
Scared as hell. And, you know, you hear a lot about the FBI, and I guess one of the big radio shows at that time was Gangbusters.
Yeah. Elliot Ness and all that.
Yeah.
What'd they ask you? What kind of stuff were they trying to get out of you?
Well, I don't remember. I think most of it just wanted to know if we were loyal and what we were up to.
And you had mentioned your father had done a lot of business with businessmen from Japan.
Yeah. So I'm sure that they didn't throw him into camp, but they did throw several, like the Buddhist priests, local Buddhist priests and stuff, were sent to a separate camp.
So December 7th happens, not long after the FBI comes to your home, interviews everybody, and I'm sure you're afraid of what's going to happen. But then a couple months later, the president issues this 9066, this executive order, basically saying that if you're a Japanese-American on the West Coast, you're an enemy alien, and you're out here in Colorado. Were you concerned that they were going to put you in a camp, put your whole family in a camp?
No, it never struck me. I really don't know why. Might have been because we didn't live in the Japanese community in Denver. We lived, I think there was only two families that lived in East Denver then. No, it didn't concern me at all, although I was aware of them being thrown into camp,
Did that make you angry to know that these people, just because of their last name or their appearance?
No, just wondered why. I didn't face any discrimination for the few months later that I was in high school until I graduated in June of 42. Although some of the fellow students just maybe were afraid to get too involved with me. All of my friends were of Caucasian descent. A lot of my closest friends were actually Jewish kids that went to the school. I don't remember any of them ever coming up and say, "Sam, don't worry, we're with you," and stuff like that. But on the other hand, they never turned their backs on me either. So I was fortunate in that sense.
And how'd you end up in the Army?
Well, I was drafted. Do you know the story about being designated an enemy alien?
Yeah.
Well, that's it. See, in 1942, I should have been drafted right away. I was 17, 18 then, 1A classification. It was in the spring of 42. They changed the classification from 1A to 4C.
Right.
I didn't fight it. I'm 4C, I'm 4C.
It didn't bother you that this country you're born in is calling you an enemy alien and unfit to serve?
No, I said, to hell with them.
You just stay out of the way and keep your nose down.
I decided I was going to work a couple of years and go to university.
Mm-hmm.
If they wanted me, they have to come after me. I wasn't about to volunteer, mainly because I knew I had a hunch of where we would end up.
Really? What was that hunch?
That we couldn't join the Air Force, we couldn't join the Navy, couldn't join the Marines or the Merchant Marine. We were headed for the Army and the part of the Army that I didn't like. If I had had a chance to, actually, after I was inducted, I volunteered for the Air Force, but they went to. So I volunteered for the Navy. I hate ships, but I volunteered just to stay out of being designated infantryman.
Right, because you knew what that meant.
Yeah.
But you're saying you saw that coming. You figured that you guys would be the expendable ones?
Well.
Or that they were going to need some bodies at some point?
You don't want to go in the infantry during a hot war. They were so hard up for replacements for the 442nd and the 100th Infantry Battalion that from the day I was inducted until I first heard my enemy shell coming over my head was less than 6 months.
Wow.
Yeah, that was May of 44. Went to Camp Shelby, Mississippi for basic training in June of 44, and they sent us home for 2 week furlough. While I was home, one of the cadre from Mississippi, who was a Colorado boy, came home and called me up, and I knew of him, but I didn't know him that well. And he says, "Sam, you better be sure and tell your folks hello, because as soon as you get back, you're going to be shipped overseas." That's first I heard of that. And it turned out that was the way it was. After my furlough was over, I went back to Mississippi, and they'd already had the mattress bag, and you fill it up. We were shipped out on a troop train to Camp Shanks, New York.
You shared with us how you were able to avoid the internment, your time here in Denver. You've got a couple of years of freedom that a lot of Japanese Americans didn't have.
No, they didn't.
But then you get to Camp Shelby, and you're around a whole lot of Japanese Americans who have been in the camps.
When I was inducted at Fort Logan in Colorado, there might have been a dozen in our group, I'm not sure. Half of them were people that grew up in the farm communities north of Denver, a couple of whom I knew. The other half came out of one of the relocation camps, Camp Amachi, which is in southeastern Colorado.
Right.
I made friends with one of the fellows that came out of Amachi. I didn't know him from Adam, and he lived in California before the evacuation. So we had a friendship until we both ended up in the 100th Battalion when we were shipped overseas. I was in A Company and he was in C Company. We survived France, and when we were shipped back to Italy, well, he was killed back in Italy.
Mm-hmm. What was his name?
Bob Suyoka. I have a picture of him, and I never have been able to locate any member of his family. You do what you're supposed to do. I wondered why it was me and not the guy next to me that got wounded or killed. I was fortunate that I got through the war without a scratch. In retrospect, I think being classified 4C may have saved my life, because I would have been drafted right away and would have been ended up in the 442nd very early on and shipped overseas when the regiment went overseas. As it was, by the time I joined as a replacement, I had missed one of the big battles, the rescue of the Lost Battalion and the capture of these two French towns, Biefontaine and Bruyères.
And that's the signature achievement of the 442, or the one that gets the most publicity, because there were more members of the 442nd Regimental Combat Team killed and wounded than there were mostly Caucasian soldiers from that Lost Battalion rescued.
Yeah. Some of the fellows, when I joined up, they had just pulled back from the front lines, and one of the fellows whose brother I had taken basic training with, we looked him up, and sure enough, he was in the medics, and you could see in his eyes the hell that he'd gone through, because I had seen him in Camp Shelby before they shipped out as a replacement themselves. He was in the group of replacements just before me.
So when you saw him over there, you saw a different look in his eye.
Oh, absolutely. You could see that. You could tell that he was through hell.
What was your first taste of combat and what this is really going to be like?
Well, at that time, it was after they'd pulled back from the front lines, and we were so depleted in manpower that they gave us easy duty in southern France. That was from November until the next spring in March of 45. Yeah, all the time our particular company were in the Maritime Alps, I guess is what they called it. It was right on the border of Italy and France.
Right.
And being in a weapons platoon, my job each night was to go up to the outpost on the border and look down into Italy and man a machine gun just in case the Germans came, tried to attack there. Although I was a mortarman by, what do they call it, MOS or something like that.
Uh-huh.
And then when dawn would break, well, then we'd get out of that machine gun nest and come back down the mountain to the backside, into the French side, because they knew that there was a machine gun nest there. In fact, the German artillery had a direct hit on it one day when we were out of the...
So the very position that you occupied the night before or the night after got hit?
It was
during
in
the
daytime.
Day.
Generally, uh-huh. The Germans wouldn't shoot their artillery at night because it would reveal their position.
Right.
Very precisely, where in the daytime they would shell us. And when we went up the next night, we saw the destruction. And it actually was a direct hit.
Wow.
We had a spare 30 caliber machine gun barrel there, and you hold it up and look through it, and you could see a dent on the inside where a shrapnel hit.
That's a pretty direct hit.
Pretty direct hit.
It's time for our first break, but we'll hear more of Sam Terasaki's World War II story when we come back. How will you observe the Day of Remembrance next weekend? Check your local area for events near you and check out the list at hometownheroesradio.com, including one that's getting an early start this weekend with author James Ardaiz. We told you about his book, Tears of Honor, last year at this time. Hometown Heroes will be right back after this. I always love hearing from listeners, and so many of you tell me you listen to Hometown Heroes while you're on the road. Nobody spends more time on the road than our friends in the trucking business. And if that's your business, I'm sure you know about Central Valley Trailer Repair. If you don't, you really should. Conveniently located near California's major transportation arteries, CVTR has stockpiles of parts waiting for you in Fresno and in Stockton, with experienced service technicians ready to handle even the most difficult of repairs. Central Valley Trailer Repair is an authorized Great Dane sales, parts, and service center, and you can always find a huge inventory of new and used semi-trailers for sale too. Dry freight, refrigerated, flatbed, whatever you're looking for, CVTR has you covered. How about 24-hour emergency service? You bet. What can't CVTR help you with? That's a question I can't answer, so you'll have to ask them yourself at 1-800-877-8444. That's 1-800-877-8444. The website? That's simple. CVTR.com for Central Valley Trailer Repair. And tell them you heard about them on Hometown Heroes. When life throws you curveballs, you have to be adaptable, or at least have a good pinch hitter on the bench who knows how to handle a curve. When it comes to your business, Provident Payments is the best teammate you could ever have. Perhaps it helps that many of the leaders for one of the fastest-growing payment consultants in America are former ballplayers. Contactless payments, online ordering, point of sale, you name it, Provident Payments knows it. Now, you could get some of these services from one of the big banking companies, but you're never going to get the kind of personalized service that Provident Payments delivers every day. 24/7 solution-based tech support. When your ability to process payments goes haywire in any way, time is money. So would you rather wait on hold for who knows how long, or would you like to have a direct line you can call for immediate help? That's where a good teammate comes in. Learn more about bringing Provident Payments onto your team at providentpayments.com. They really are one of the fastest-growing payment consultants in America. That website again, providentpayments.com.
Proudly presented by Provident Payments, this is Hometown Heroes, celebrating everyday Americans who answer the call of duty.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes and an episode bringing your attention to next weekend's 80th anniversary of Executive Order 9066, so you can prepare for Day of Remembrance observances near you. Sam Terasaki was one of 33,000 Americans of Japanese ancestry to serve in our armed forces during World War II. He was leading a mortar squad in Company A of the 100th Infantry Battalion, which by the time he made it overseas had become part of the famed 442nd Regimental Combat Team.
From November until March, the replacements kept coming over, more and more replacements to fill the depleted ranks.
Right. There were so many casualties, there were a lot to replace.
That's right. Then when we were considered full strength, well, that's when we shipped back to Italy. Didn't know it at that time, but when we came home with the regimental colors and had the honor of marching for President Truman, at that time it was Secretary of War Stimson, I believe, that told us that we're a unique outfit in that we were not under the jurisdiction of any one army or any one general or anything. They all had to go through the War Department. General Clark had the 100th Battalion in Italy. He didn't want to give them up, but Truscott in France wanted them from the invasion of southern France and for the battle into Germany. Clark lost out. The regiment, including the 100th Battalion, was sent to France. That's when they got involved, not only in the invasion of southern France. Some of the units flew into southern France on gliders.
Yeah.
Where they happened to end up rescuing the remnants of the regiment that was encircled. They were getting ready for the last offensive against the Germans, so Clark wanted the regiment back in Italy. So that's why we went from Italy to France and back to Italy, all the time in combat.
And I want to hear about what you experienced in Italy, but you just gave us an overview of the things that happened before you got there. And by the time you got there, this moniker, Go for Broke, I'm sure was well established. Is that something that you heard when you joined the unit?
Heard it more on the crap table than...
Well, that's where it originated, right?
That absolutely. It's a Hawaiian slang for all or nothing. And the guys would be rolling dice on the army blanket and say, okay, and he's down to his last chips. I'll go for broke. Yeah.
What did that mean to you? I mean, if you have to explain that to someone who's never even heard that term, and they say, well, why was 442 known as the Go for Broke unit?
Well, just explain to them. That's a Hawaiian term for... Yeah. All or nothing. I think the thing I remember most is when I came down from the mountains, checked in at the desk at the hotel where the rest center was, I saluted the captain. Actually, he was a dentist, Captain Komitani from Hawaii in the original 100th Battalion, and at that time was designated as a morale officer for the regiment. And I saluted him and told him my name, and he said, where are you from? And I said, Denver, Colorado. And he said, really? Because I took your sister out on dates. Turns out that he had gone to Denver University, and that's where my older sister had gone.
What a small world.
It's a small world.
That's crazy.
That's something you won't forget. But anyway, the other thing is, when my rest was over, well, we'd take all day to hike back to the top of the mountain. The number of the old-timers had just come back from New York. The old-timers in the 100th Battalion then were mostly from Hawaii, so they didn't get to go to Hawaii on rotation, but they did get to go back to the mainland. It just so happened that Captain Fukuda, who later became battalion commander, was in our group that were going back up the mountain to the outpost. As I said, it took all day to climb up there. So during one of our rest stops, I don't know why he brought it up, except that I guess he was an educator in Hawaii before he was drafted. And he said, you know, I just came back from New York on rotation. He scolded some of the guys for practicing racial discrimination on their own, that you're all in the same boat. I don't know whether they realized it, but they looked down upon the African Americans at that time. I think there were some problems with the California Nisei and the Mexican laborers. Didn't treat them quite like they should have. So he just kind of lectured to us during one of our rests, climbing up back up to the outpost, which I thought was, in hindsight, is probably what you'd expect from a guy like Fukuda.
It was eye-opening for you, it sounds like.
Yeah, it was.
And why do I have the feeling that there were some eye-opening moments for you when you got to Italy?
Well, we got to Italy. They gave us all new rifles and mortars and stuff. We did a little practicing. I guess one of the highlights was the fact that General Clark came up in a jeep to address the 100th Battalion, and knowing that we were going to go into battle, and the Battle of the Gothic Line, wished us well and welcomed us back to Italy and so forth. It was day after or so that night, I'm not sure which, and we pushed off and were hauled in the big open bed trucks up to the front lines and then walked the rest of the way up the hill in the dark until we were committed to battle on the morning of April 5th.
Were you prepared for what you were going to experience?
No, because I hadn't experienced anything like that where you're throwing grenades at each other. We set up our mortar in a foxhole that had been dug by American forces that were there ahead of us. My best Army buddy, who was from originally from Oxnard, California, who settled in Atlanta, Georgia, Mike Doy, he and I were in the mortar squad that I was in charge of, set up our mortar, and while up above us, the guys in the rifle platoons were fighting.
So you're seeing things and hearing things and probably smelling things and experiencing things that you've never experienced before.
Well, the foxhole was dug in a position where there was a huge rock on our left side, up against a huge rock. A rifle grenade or potato masher, I think it was a rifle grenade, came down and luckily hit on the opposite side of that rock.
So bang. Only a few feet from you, maybe 10 feet or something?
No, inches.
But the rock was in between you and the impact.
Yeah.
So if the rock's not there,
we're gone. We're gone. One of the, I don't know whether he was an officer or not, he was in the outfit that was there before we replaced them, came down the trail. It was a narrow, very narrow trail. He's kind of chuckling. I think he was happy that he's going to go to the rear echelon. He says, those guys are up there throwing grenades at each other. Well, that's what happened. In fact, the one Medal of Honor that was bestowed during the war was Spud Munimori, who was in our company, A Company. In fact, I'd just talked to him an hour before when the rifle platoon was cutting through our line to get ahead of us, and I just happened to see him, and I said, okay, well, take it easy, Spud. And it was still dark, and that was the last I saw him. He was killed, saving the life of two of his squad members by jumping on the grenade before it exploded. Took his own life, saved their lives.
I can tell in your eyes and in your voice that he's someone you admire and respect.
Absolutely. And it's something that I never talked about for maybe 50 years after the fact, I guess. I don't know how many years it was, but I just couldn't talk about it without crying. It was my family. We had a dinner at home, and I don't know how the subject came up, but I started crying. I guess somebody wanted to know about the war, and I had to excuse myself. And I find that the more you talk about it, the easier it is to do it without getting so emotional. But some things that, horrible things that, you know, we had, I think, five guys in our company alone that had their foot blown off that morning of the 5th of April.
Your first day in combat.
Yeah, and they had their foot blown off, and the litter bearers, like I say, the trail up to the front lines was so narrow that they had to come by our gun emplacement. And
so you're seeing them come by one after one after the other.
Yeah.
And wondering when you're going to be.
Well, I remember two in particular. One, I didn't know him, but he was a rifleman, I'm sure, had stepped on a mine, and the litter bearers were taking him back to the first aid station, and he kept saying, "Itai, itai," which in Japanese means it hurts, it hurts. What was left of his foot, they put back on the litter because it had fallen off the side. It was hanging there by the skin. Another fellow that I remember was Lieutenant Novak, who was a platoon leader, and had his foot blown off. Oh, he was, even though they medics must have given him a shot of morphine, he was still in pain. You could hear him moaning all the way down the mountain as they carried him down to the aid station. Novak eventually became an MD, lost his foot, of course. And during one of our reunions, here's this rabbi that showed up at one of our reunions, and turns out he was Lieutenant Novak's son. And he wanted to know if there were any guys around at the reunion that knew his dad. And there were a couple.
And there were a couple non-Japanese American members of these units. And some people don't realize that. They hear 100th Battalion or 442, and they assume every single member was Japanese American. How did you guys interact with those who weren't Japanese American?
Well, it was easy for me because I grew up in an all-Caucasian community, very few Japanese. Actually, it was kind of a cultural thing for me. For instance, I grew up with eating half the time Japanese meals, half the time American meals, meat and potatoes.
Mm-hmm.
But when we were in basic training and when we were overseas, we ate as much rice as we could get our hands on, trade our chocolate candy and cigarettes for rice when we were in Italy. Came home and always wanted rice, and my mother told my wife, my future wife, she says, I thought Sam was in the wrong army. He wanted rice all the time.
She thought you were wearing the rising sun, huh? You described for us April 5th, 45, your first day in combat. And people know that the war in Europe lasted another month beyond that. After experiencing that, seeing guys coming by with legs blown off, knowing that grenade landed so close that if the rock's not there, you're not there, how did you sleep that night? How did you cope with that on a daily basis moving forward?
I don't know. Those things you don't, at least I don't remember. I know we moved forward. Had to crawl through a minefield that the scouts had marked where the mines were, the same minefield that blew these guys' ankles off. Marked it with toilet paper, which we always carried. Take a sheet of toilet paper and put a little clot of dirt on it, and you knew it was safe to step there.
Well, that was my question. Did you know it was safe, or you just knew some weren't safe? It doesn't mean there aren't necessarily more out there that nobody found yet,
there
right?
There were more out there, but it just scared as hell and went ahead step by step, hoping that you didn't step on a mine that wasn't marked. We got through there and kept pushing the Germans back town to town from where we initially attacked to these little coastal towns, Massa, Carrara, where the famous marble quarry is, La Spezia, where the Italians had a naval base, Genoa.
And you're leading a mortar squad that entire time?
Yeah, carrying a mortar.
When you're firing that mortar, how frequent are those rounds, or what is that process like when you're in a position where...
Well, every time we would stop in a position, we'd set up our mortar and just wait for orders from the front, from the guys ahead of us.
You had a forward observer who's given you coordinates for a target?
Exactly, exactly. I know one time we set up our mortar in the marble quarry in Carrara, shooting straight, almost straight up over the marble mountain to positions that they thought they were in. I don't remember exact location was, but another time we set up our mortar and they called for some rounds, so we sent a couple of rounds over the mountain. And, you know, being a mortar man, you don't know. Whether
you never see what you're hitting.
That's right. The only thing on that particular time when we moved forward, we saw a bunch of bloody bandages and stuff like that. We don't know whether...
You don't know if it's from you or...
No.
Well, and correct me if I'm wrong, but if you're firing a mortar, they start to figure out where those shells are coming from, right? And then you're probably taking some incoming also?
Oh, yeah. That was the thing that they worried the most. The artillery, you could hear it coming. Mortar rounds, you didn't hear it until it was just before it exploded. You hear a squish, and a shh, bang. Whereas German 88, you'd hear shoo, and then it would explode.
It's time for our final break, but when we come back, we'll find out how close those enemy rounds came to Sam. Again, a link to any of our interviews with Nisei vets as you prepare for this year's Day of Remembrance and the 80th anniversary of Executive Order 9066. Head over to hometownheroesradio.com, and we'll be right back after this. Do you ever have those moments where you realize you've been settling for less than the best for far too long? Sometimes we just accept the status quo without looking around for better ways to do things. And I've got to tell you, when it comes to your money, I believe I found a better way with EECU. Take a look at myeecu.org, and you'll see why. EECU is not a bank. It's a nonprofit credit union that's all about taking care of you, the member. That's one of the reasons EECU just keeps growing and growing. Close to 300,000 members now in 10 different California counties. Over 30,000 ATMs, free mobile banking. And what I really love is how EECU always goes above and beyond to serve the community. In 2013, the leadership and generosity of EECU helped establish Central Valley Honor Flight. More than 1,000 veterans now have gotten to see their memorials in Washington, D.C. for free. And that's just one example of the community involvement EECU takes oh so seriously. Pick up the phone and become a member today. 1-800-538-3328. That's 800-538-3328. Let's try a little experiment here. I'm going to say a common three-word phrase, and I want you to pay attention to what kind of reaction it produces for you. You ready? Here we go. Buying a car. Okay, be honest, did you tense up a little? If so, I don't blame you. Buying a car can be really stressful, and I've got three more words for you to make sure you do get it right. You ready? Farney Automotive Group. We recently went looking for our daughter's first car, and I made a beeline for Selma because I knew my friends at Farney Ford, Farney Buick GMC, and Toyota of Selma were people I could trust. Trust is a very important word when it comes to buying a car. And here's my advice. Regardless of what kind of vehicle you're looking for, start your search at Toyota of Selma because you can check out their wall of honor with group photos from every single Central Valley Honor Flight. Over 1,300 veterans who have their pictures on the wall there and also got a free oversized group photo from their trip to D.C. thanks to the generosity of the Farney Automotive Group. So new or used, big or small, start your car search today at Toyota of Selma. You can't miss it on the west side of the 99 at the Floral Avenue exit. And don't leave without visiting that wall of honor.
Honoring veterans from sea to shining sea. You're listening to Hometown Heroes with Paul Leffler. Brought to you by this local station and its sponsors. And presented everywhere, on the air and online, by Provident Payments, one of the fastest growing payment consultants in America. Connect today at providentpayments.com.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes, focusing on the 33,000 American men and women of Japanese ancestry who served in our armed forces during World War II, many of them doing so while their family members were still held captive by the very country for whom they were risking their lives. Sam Terasaki wasn't in Europe all that long with the go-for-broke soldiers of the 442nd Regimental Combat Team, but it was long enough to experience some very close calls.
So how close did German mortar rounds come to your position?
We were leaving a fort in North Italy, spent the night in the fort, old, old fort, ancient fort that had a moat around it, bars on the windows. When we left there, we were shelled that night, but the artillery shells hit the wall, so all it did is kind of knock the breath out of us, but it didn't penetrate the walls because they were so thick. But when we pushed out of there, we followed this stone wall that bordered the roadside. Just then a mortar attack happened. Turns out that one of our jeeps was just coming back, and I think he must have been a forward observer or something from ahead of us. For some reason, he stopped there. There was a wall in between us and where the jeep was and where we were resting, and mortar shells came down. Next thing you know, the guy's laying on the ground. One of our guys is laying on the ground on the road, hollering, "Medics, medics." So I think it was Mike and myself jumped over the wall and went over there and put a bandage on his calf. He was had a bad slash, a shrapnel slash on his calf. We all carried this first aid thing. It's a pad where you put it on there and then tie it as tight as you can. Compress is what it was. That's closest I came to a mortar attack, I think. On the 5th of April, I don't think we were exposed to as many mortar attacks as we were to artillery and to grenades, rifle grenades.
And you told us about the one, the grenade that landed on the other side of the rock.
Yeah.
Were there other situations that you look back on now and say, hey, that was pretty close?
Oh, I guess in one town, as we pushed forward in Italy, in one town, we were getting shelled fortunately, one of the shells didn't hit us, but hit the house down the road from us. And I think it was some B Company guys got killed then. I jumped in a haystack. The Italian farmhouses had their animals on the first floor and their living quarters on the second floor. This is on the first floor. Jumped in the haystack, not realizing the place was full of fleas. I fought the fleas for the next 2 months.
Regretted that decision?
Well, I itched a lot, scratched a lot.
I guess it would be worth it if being in the haystack saved your life.
That's right. And it just so happened that the guy that was driving the truck full of artillery shells or whatever it was, parked the car and ran into the house. And here's this truck loaded with ammunition. And of course, the Germans didn't hit it. Been one hell of an explosion. I don't know what the name of the town. You know, as a infantryman or mortarman, you don't get the latest news. In fact, some of the old-timers knew that the war was going to end then. We never knew that.
When did you figure it out, and what did it mean to you?
Didn't believe it. We were in a town northern Italy after we had captured a number of Germans and had them on the run. I was in a town, spent a miserable night in this town square, rained all night, covered myself with my shelter half, and woke up in the morning and all kinds of native Italians running around said the war is over. I didn't believe them, but it was shortly after that an observation plane flew over and dumped the bundles of the Stars and Stripes and said the war is over. That's when I knew.
How big of a relief was that?
Oh, you don't. I remember none of the guys jumped up and down or anything. It just kind of took it as a matter of fact. We were happy that it was over, and it was a day or two later we had a memorial service at an abandoned warehouse. Our chaplain delivered a sermon and read the names of all the guys in the 100th from the first one that was killed down in Salerno. Very sad. Couldn't help from crying.
I believe it. And I'm sure, even though, as you're telling it, there was only about a month that you spent in real intense combat, that had to be the longest month of your life, right?
Yeah, I think so.
And sure, there had to be days in there where you thought your name could have been one of those that chaplains read.
Well, maybe wondered why I'd survived and the others didn't.
Did you have days where you thought that was going to be it? Did
you? Oh, sure, yeah. Pray to God when we're under artillery fire that the next one wouldn't come over and hit us.
It's got to be a pretty helpless feeling.
It is. What do? Put your hands over your head and hug the ground as much as you can and hope that you don't get hit. I know I recited the Lord's Prayer all the time.
I'm just imagining being in those shoes and how lonely and scary and just difficult that must have been.
It was. It was scary. When your legs start shaking, you can't stop it from shaking. That's when I knew I was scared.
And you mentioned that memorial service while you're still there in Italy, and the war has just ended, and they're reading off name after Japanese surname. Some of those guys are probably guys you knew?
Yeah.
And you told, you're crying.
Yeah.
How should we, today, remember those guys whose names you heard read that day?
Well, I don't know. I just live a good life. Pay them back by living a good life and being tolerant. You know, when I joined the outfit, from the old-timers, I heard maybe three or four names of guys that they all looked up to. One of them, who was our chaplain, Israel Yost, Pennsylvania Dutch chaplain, that never knew what an American of Japanese ancestry was. In fact, he was given the option of not being in the 100th Battalion if he didn't want to be. I told him that this is made up of all Japanese Americans, and you don't have to be part of it if you don't want to. And he says, no, it makes no difference to him. He wanted to be a combat chaplain, and that's what he did. So he was one of the guys that all of the old-timers used to talk about, because he wasn't the chaplain that stayed in the back. He was a chaplain right up there with the medics, retrieving bodies, giving the last rites, things like that. Two more. Fukuda ended up as battalion commander in the end. Didn't have to lead the Fukuda task force, which was actually just, I think, one or two jeeps going from the last place in northern Italy that we went to. They drove all the way up to the Swiss border. He very well could have been shot by a sniper or something. A Korean-American who was our battalion intelligence officer. They were aware of the friction between Koreans and Japan.
Yeah.
So they gave him also the option. Of course, he says, I grew up in Los Angeles. My father had a grocery store there. I have a lot of Japanese American friends. That makes no difference to me. He gained a lot of respect. When the 100th Battalion was Anzio, they needed information. He crawled on his belly and took two non-coms with him. He crawled on his belly all night and grabbed a couple of German prisoners and made them crawl all the way back, and they got information.
Sounds like those guys set a pretty powerful example.
He did.
Were you excited to come home?
Oh, absolutely. Even though it was a slow ship, I went over on the Queen Mary, which was a fast ship.
Yeah.
Came home on a Victory ship, which was a slow ship. But we were bringing home the regimental colors in the summertime, sleep on the deck at night, ice cream every night.
Hey, hey.
Movies. When we hit New York Harbor, because it was a big celebration that the city of New York and the Army put on for us, welcoming the regiment home, big to-do in New York Harbor, and then preparing to march in Washington, D.C.
What was that like?
I think we drilled for almost 2 weeks at Belvoir, Virginia, across the Potomac from D.C., got new uniforms and everything. And then they went over to D.C. and it was a rainy day, but the story goes that asked Truman, he said, in light of the weather, you want to cancel, and he says, no. He supposedly said, what these boys been through, what's a little rain? So He came out of the White House to the Ellipse, which is a oval-shaped area across from the White House, and we passed in review, and he had a rain trench coat on and pinned the presidential unit citation on our regimental colors and welcomed us home.
Quite the contrast from being told you're 4C.
Well, it is. Thinking back makes you wonder. Roosevelt, I don't think he really knew the character of the Americans of Japanese ancestry that lived in this country. He was born and raised in New York, and I don't think there are very many Japanese back there.
I've noticed a few times now that every time you refer to it, you use the verbiage, Americans of Japanese ancestry. You don't want a hyphen in there anywhere.
No.
Why is that?
I've been approached by a number of people, and because of my facial features and stuff, they say, are you Japanese? I know what they mean.
Right.
But I make it a point, say, no, I'm an American. Not to embarrass them, but what they have to realize is that America is made up of all different ethnic groups. And I'm an American. I just happen to be an American of Japanese ancestry.
And when you are in front of the White House with the President of the United States pinning the highest honor he can give to a unit on your unit colors, I guess you guys proved how American you were.
Never occurred to me.
And you said something to me. You'd be eligible for a Bronze Star for having been a combat soldier in Europe. You'd be eligible for a medal from the French government for helping to liberate that country. And you have not taken advantage of those opportunities. And you told me that the things that mean the most to you are that PUC, that Presidential Unit Citation, and your Combat Infantry Badge. Why? Why do those two decorations give you pride?
I've seen too many guys who deserve more than they got. One of the things that when I went over and we're in our off times, we'd talk about it, and the guys would say, well, so-and-so should have gotten a Medal of Honor. He didn't. He got a Distinguished Service Cross instead. And it said all in how you write it up. And apparently our higher-ups didn't know how to exactly write up a citation. That was part of it, and probably a lesser part than the fact that they weren't about to give a Congressional Medal of Honor to. There was even controversy about giving a Congressional Medal of Honor to Munimori.
Well, and the thing that backs that up is what President Clinton did in the 90s, which was upgrade some of those Distinguished Service Crosses to Medals of Honor for guys like your friend Joe Sakato here in Denver.
So I told my son and my family, they, why didn't you apply for those? Medals don't mean that much to me.
I do want to ask you about one other medal, though, because this was in the last decade here. 60 years after the war, they say the Congressional Gold Medal goes to all Nisei veterans.
And my son, I wasn't even going to go to that, but my family insisted I go, and they said, well, you need an escort. I said, I could do it myself. My son said, oh, I'd like to go anyway. So we went, and we were there for the ceremony.
What did that mean to you, that the Congress of the United States is singling you out as saying you did something worth celebrating.
It meant a lot to me that we were getting the recognition that we deserved. On the other hand, we're sitting back there several rows back, and the politicians are sitting in front of us. And I told my son, I said, where were they when we needed them? But it was good because Danny Nowak gave a nice speech.
I was going to say, he's the one politician you couldn't blame because he's a Medal of Honor winner.
Yeah.
Well, I don't want to forget to say something important. Thank you. Thank you for serving our country, and thank you for telling us this story from your perspective. When it comes to the Americans of Japanese ancestry who served our country during World War II, what gives you the most pride? And what do you think is the biggest thing that the rest of us who weren't around then need to know and remember?
I'm glad I served. My feeling is it opened the doors for the rest of our children. They're doing things that we wouldn't even think of doing now. So it's life is easier, even though I know that they face discrimination once in a while. So I think we opened a lot of doors. That was because the Nisei soldiers did a good job. The guys in the MIS did a good job. The other thing is I want to make sure that this story is told over and over again, something like the Jewish Holocaust. If you don't talk about it, they're going to forget.
And it could happen again.
It could happen again. The fact that I let you interview me and the fact that I've been interviewed before, and it's because I want the rest of the America to know what we did during the war, that we're Americans just like anyone else that was born here, even though we look different.
Amen. And when you say you opened a lot of doors, tell me if I'm wrong when I say this. Aren't some of the other doors that you opened the gates to those internment camps? Even though you never had to spend time in them, what you guys did overseas made it impossible for the government to ignore and really force their hand in releasing those people who had been wrongly imprisoned?
Yeah.
What would you say you're most thankful for, Sam?
That I have a good family. Thankful that I'm blessed the way I am.
And what a blessing for us to hear his story. He mentioned the man from his company, Spud Munamori, who was the first Nisei veteran awarded the Medal of Honor. We also talked about another, Sam's friend Joe Sakato, who had his decoration upgraded to the Medal of Honor decades later. You can link to Sakato's story at hometownheroesradio.com. As of today, there are only 66 Americans still living who have received our nation's highest honor. Only one of them is a Nisei veteran. Our friends listening on affiliate KIVA, The Rock of Talk, in Albuquerque know all about Hershey Miyamura, the pride of Gallup, New Mexico, who served with Sam Terasaki in the 100th and 442 toward the end of World War II, but he went on to earn the Medal of Honor during the Korean War. The National Medal of Honor Museum just launched its annual initiative encouraging all of us to write letters to surviving Medal of Honor recipients. Maybe you'd like to send one Hershey's way. Maybe to all 66. You have some time now because the goal is to have them all in by National Medal of Honor Day next month. And I have all of that info linked for you at hometownheroesradio.com. Whether you've ever participated in a Day of Remembrance observance before, why not take the initiative to do it this year and spread the word? Because a giant component of making sure that tragic history never repeats itself is simply making sure that those elements of history are not forgotten. Thanks so much for listening to Hometown Heroes today. I'm Paul Leffler, reminding you again of something our Nisei veterans know all too well. Freedom is not free.
To let Paul know about a veteran in your life, visit hometownheroesradio.com and click on Suggest a Veteran. Today's program has been brought to you by Provident Payments. Give your business the edge only their personalized service can deliver at providentpayments.com.